Okay, so Fred, take it away.
Very good, Rachel. I am entering a link into the system that should bring up our presentation. So everyone, welcome. It's good to, well, I suppose it's good to see you, but I can't see anyone. So I hope that you're looking forward to an interesting time. We're going to be covering the topics, the multi-scalar 3D documentation, a couple of mechanics to go over with you. You should have a link that Rachel sent around that will allow you to view this presentation in a standard browser. Sometimes we found that the webinar software can be a little delayed, so if you want to bring up a separate browser, you'll be seeing the same slides in that browser as you will in this window. And the second point that Rachel has made, if you would be so kind as to mute your talk button, the little button right over to the left there under the audio and video section, that will help the whole process. And there will be very specific times throughout you'll be an opportunity to ask questions. I'm also monitoring the chat section, so if you either have sound problems or other reasons, please feel free to send questions at any point through the chat, and we'll pick those up. We want to cover a number of topics today in the process, but we want to make sure that you get information that you find useful. We're going to talk a little bit about some of the basics of these technologies. Many of you may be very familiar with them. Some of them may be new to you. So we'll go over that a little bit. We're going to talk about some of the aspects of these. What is it good for? The essence of the issue is not that a new technology is available, but having become available, how can it affect how we do archaeology, heritage management, and those sorts of things? And so I'm particularly interested in your questions. If you have a particular type of strategy or an approach, we want to look at X. So be thinking about those questions as we go along. We're going to talk to you about how to decide. There's a lot of information out there. These can be technically challenging. Some of them are easier, some of them are harder. And we'll give you some parameters to decide which of these strategies you might want to take advantage of. And again, I really invite you to ask questions, particularly as we sort of looked at all of them, and you can say, well, would you use this or would you use that for this particular situation? So again, we'll also be presenting you some more sources of information. That's a really important process of the whole thing. And as I've said, lots of questions throughout the entire discussion. So there'll be opportunities specifically throughout for discussion questions. So we're going to talk about what I call at least HDSM, which is just an acronym for stands for Height Density Survey and Measurement. It encompasses a number of technologies, and we're going to go over all of these in a little bit of detail, which is airborne photogrammetry, airborne LIDAR, high-resolution GPS, actually more accurately GNSS. Everyone's familiar with GPS, but you may not be familiar with the very high-resolution capabilities. We're going to talk about what a lot of people refer to as laser scanning of objects and buildings, and then we're going to talk about finally, a technology called terrestrial photogrammetry. So those are our basic topics. So we need to understand that these different methods sort of operate at different scales. Archaeologists and heritage managers are very familiar with scale issues. And so we've sort of tried to organize the left-hand side of the slide along with the right-hand. So you can sort of see where these technologies fit. So for example, you probably won't be using terrestrial photogrammetry to look at landscape level problems and so on. Again, we'll look more at that in detail as we go forward, but be aware these techniques sort of work in different scales at different levels. Okay, so it's also important that we understand that a particular, there's no one magic tool, no one particular strategy that's useful by itself. And also, it's important to understand that just like in an environment, a healthy ecosystem, you've got to have everything, the air, the water, the soil, to be healthy. You have a similar situation in a digital ecosystem. By that, we mean that you don't want to just think about the equipment to acquire the data. You have to think about, well, how am I going to represent this? How am I going to measure things? How am I going to store the data? all sorts of things like that. We're not going to talk about all of those at length, but we do want those to be very clear in your mind. Here's one slide. There's lots of different ways you could represent it, but there's all sorts of pieces in this process. And while you may think the first thing is to go out and perhaps acquire an instrument, in fact, that's a relatively small piece of this whole process. And we can maybe have other lectures along the way about these other questions. But we're going to focus primarily at this point in this lecture on some of the first steps. So the first particular technology that we're going to look at is aerial photogrammetry. This particular technology has been around literally for about 100 years or so, and it essentially consists of an aircraft, used to be at least an aircraft, that would fly parallel lines taking overlapping, quote, stereo, close quote, photographs. There are a number of technical issues in this process, things called interior orientation, exterior orientation, ground control points, and so on. We won't go into that, but if you've worked with this before, you know that there's a number of technical issues that are and have been in the past very important for aerial photogrammetry to work. Now, in the last few years, the process has become more automated, as has everything. And now it is possible to take overlapping stereo photographs, feed those into the computer, and extract out a great deal of information about the objects, about the elevation, and so on. We'll come back to this, but I just want to sort of set the stage to remind everyone that aerial photogrammetry has been around for a very long time. Some examples, this is the Cusco Basin area, and the reason that we bring this up is that in many instances, and particularly around the world, there's a wide range of historic aerial photographs. And it is possible to extract a great deal of information from these that may be of great relevance for archaeological purposes. It's also a very changing landscape, and UAVs, drones, various tech terms are used, are becoming increasingly important, particularly to acquire very high resolution aerial photography. This is an example. There are many different kinds of drones that are out there. You can see some images to the lower right of the screen. This is actually an aerial imaging camera that's on top of the, or on the bottom rather, of the drone. And in the next set of images, we can see that this happens to be, for example, a Berry Kiva. You can see in the upper left-hand side, the architectural characteristics of the Kiva are quite clear from the thermal imagery. It is now possible to program in very controlled paths for the instrument. It takes off, flies around, comes back, at least when it's all working. And so UAVs present a very important new direction, specifically for archaeologically relevant, high-resolution aerial photogrammetric sources. And again, we can return to discussing these as we go forward. I want to introduce another one before we stop for questions, however, and that is a somewhat related technology, which is aerial LIDAR. Essentially, in the LIDAR system, an instrument is on an aircraft, though they're getting smaller and now can be found on UAVs. It fires a laser beam, it measures the time of transit, the angular materials, and so on, and can prepare very high resolution elevation data. But it also is measuring whatever it strikes. So for example, there may be buildings, there may be vegetation, and so on. There are a number of techniques and methods that can be used to process this data. This is an example of some raw LIDAR data points, in this case around the University of Arkansas campus, and you can see that the density of the points, there you can see sort of the buildings, you can get a feel for that. This is a relatively low density LIDAR data set. Again, these vary, and one of the things that we're finding out is that LIDAR is growing dramatically in its use in archaeology. I want to make a couple of points here. Generally speaking, the direct application of LIDAR to archaeological and heritage issues is probably substantially more advanced in Europe than it is in the United States. One of the things that we have in the United States is that there are large areas for which there are LIDAR data that have been acquired by the U.S. Geological Survey and others for their hydrologic and other data purposes. Generally speaking, that data, while very useful, is probably not really high resolution for archaeological purposes. Nonetheless, LIDAR is a very important data source, and one of the things that it's particularly useful for is the discovery of large extensive features, particularly that are subtle. In Europe, for example, many examples in which earthworks, very shallow it turns out in character, were discovered in locations that had been repeatedly surveyed, but because the size of the earthwork was so large and its representation so subtle, it was only with the LIDAR data that this sort of large aerial information became quite clear. So LIDAR is a very important technology of great value to many archaeological situations. Okay, we said that we would pause and invite questions, so let me do so. We've covered two of the technologies so far. Any questions, please, you can send them via chat. If you want to click on your button and ask the questions, we'll pause now. Again, I know sometimes it's technically difficult to get things to work. I want to make sure before we go ahead, another opportunity, there'll be others. Okay, we have one in the chat. In what ways can USGS data be, hold on just a minute, I've got to scroll over here to see all of it, be refined for use in US archaeology? Excellent question. One of the things that you need to be aware of as archaeologists is there are many variations, but two important different types of the data that's being used by USGS. That's the raw LIDAR data and the processed LIDAR data. The processed LIDAR data is typically processed for the purpose of developing what is referred to as a bare earth model, or basically it's an attempt to characterize the surface of the earth. A variety of algorithms are used to remove LIDAR returns from trees, from houses, and from other features. And also the resolution of data necessary for most of the surface modeling that's done is relatively low density, perhaps one or two LIDAR points per square meter, sometimes less. Two things to be aware of. Oftentimes, the algorithms and the methods used to clean up, quote unquote, the LIDAR data remove features that may be of interest for archaeology. Sometimes it does. So be very cautious when you're looking at a processed LIDAR data set. In many instances, there may be much more information in the raw LIDAR. But of course, that requires that you have to process the raw LIDAR. In the processed LIDAR that you get, the bare earth, essentially, as you saw in that one case, the Hopewell earthwork, features of some character and some extensive nature can be very obvious. So for example, trails, very extensive earthworks, landscape modifications such as the residual evidences of canals and features of that kind. So in particular, features that have a substantial aerial expression are very, very good for discovery, even in the USGS processed LIDAR. So think about resolution, think about the processing methods, and that may be useful to give you an idea of when it will work and when it won't work. Any other questions about LIDAR before we move on? Very good. Question, what programs do we need to work with LIDAR data? There are a variety of software packages out there. A very common GIS package called ArcGIS, I'm sure many of you are familiar with that, has increasingly become capable of at least basic modification and analysis of LIDAR. There are a variety of specialized LIDAR processing tools. Some of these are open source. Some of these are commercial in character. And I think probably the best thing to say is any of you have specific questions on some specific software, why don't you drop us an email and we'll respond to that. I've got another one. It says, what resources are available for automated feature extraction? Well, that's a very good question. There are a variety of software products out there, some that use a technology called object recognition. Others use a variety of different algorithms. There's automated features and there are automated features. And one of the questions is, what kind of feature do you really want to be interested in? And in most instances, they're not really automated, but they're semi-automated. And by setting specific parameters, you can feature or highlight archaeologically relevant things. Or in other instances, you may face problems where the automated software that you're using actually gets rid of archaeology. So it's very important to understand the internal characteristics of the algorithms and whether or not they're effective for archaeology. The problem is very similar in geophysics. Many of the, quote, traditional geophysics algorithms actually treat archaeology as the noise. And that's kind of a similar situation in LIDAR. But again, I suggest, in order to continue, please follow up on that. Drop Rachel or myself a email and we can go into more detail. Final question is, can we buy the LIDAR equipment? Right now, it's relatively expensive, particularly the better instruments, but the price is falling. So I guess the answer right now is no, you probably can't, and it probably makes more sense for you to hire an individual that has both the platform, an aircraft, and the instrument. But again, things are changing, and we're going to see prices probably falling literally hour by hour, week by week, perhaps. Well, we'll come back to these at the end and be happy to answer more of these, but let's move on to some other technologies. Again, I really appreciate the questions and we'll come back to them. I want to introduce something that oftentimes many archaeologists work with but don't think of as high resolution, and that's, quote, GPS. We use GNSS now, the Global Navigation Satellite System, because there are Russian satellites and Chinese satellites and Indian satellites and a variety of others. I just want to make a few points here, and again, we can come back. Under the, quote, survey grade, you'll hear that term, GPS receivers, they're very high resolution, potentially down to millimeters, certainly very easy to achieve centimeter resolution, and it, in many instances, can be done quite rapidly, a few seconds per observation. So it's important for you to know that this is out there, the sort of technology that most archaeologists use, are what we refer to as mapping grade, and that's perfectly adequate for many purposes, but there are many other instances where you have much higher resolution in terms of the data. The other thing to be aware of is we've talked about LIDAR, we're going to talk about photogrammetry, we're going to talk about terrestrial laser scanning. These all create data, and right now, in most instances, they're floating. We're not exactly sure where they are. And so one of the things that we may want to have our high-resolution GPS or GNSS instruments for is to locate these data points in what we refer to as geodetic space, that is to say precisely where they are in the three-dimensional world. I'll move on past that, but again, lots of interesting developments in this area and a much higher resolution perhaps than you may be familiar with and much faster than you perhaps we're aware of for this very high resolution resource. Very important one, but we'll move on. Before I do so though, one of the things I want to say is that there are some dramatic enhancements and improvements in the satellite constellations, so this is only going to get better. There's a group of satellites that are going to be launched in the relatively near term, assuming budgets permit. They're going to have a much stronger signal, they'll have multiple frequencies, and they're going to work in a lot of environments where probably GPS wasn't particularly successful in the past. And then, of course, with the Russian, the Chinese, and Indian, and other satellites, we have a much larger constellation of satellites. Anyway, important things that are happening in that particular domain. I want to move on now to a technology referred to by various sorts of things. It used to be called terrestrial photogrammetry. It oftentimes is referred to from the computer science literature as structure from motion, but we'll just talk a little bit about what we're looking at here. What we're essentially doing, what we're talking about, is taking overlapping photos, these stereo photos, once again, typically with a good quality, but not what we refer to as a metric camera. Metric camera is a very specialized device, but a high quality digital SLR type camera. We take overlapping photographs with some particular characteristics, which we won't go into now. And once we have those, we are then able to process those and create accurate three-dimensional representations. Now, what you see here are some screen captures from a couple, 2 or 3 year old software that did this. And what basically you did in that case was you walked around the thing of interest. It might be a building, it might be a large geological structure, it might be an object. You would take overlapping photographs, you would send that into the software, and then you would essentially get two photographs side by side, and you would manually say, this location and this photograph is that location and that photograph. You'd do that repeatedly for multiple overlapping pairs of photographs as you sort of moved around the building. And what then the software could do is it could reverse, as it were, calculate the location of the camera. You had to process some things to calibrate the camera. You essentially took a photograph of a controlled field. And as a result of those inputs, the software could figure out where the camera was. And then once it figured out where the camera was, it could sort of reverse calculate the locations of the photographs related to each other. And essentially then what you see here is a sense of the building being built, as it were, from the three-dimensional coordinates that the cameras calculated, the overlapping points, and then the software essentially pasted, as it were, photographed the textures onto the particular surfaces that were created during the process. And when this first came out, this was extraordinary. Previous technologies required very expensive cameras, a lot of problems in the past. So these developments of 5 to 7 years ago were quite extraordinary. But there were some problems. So for example, here's a series of photographs of about 400 photographs of Sacsayhuama, which is above Cuzco. And imagine working through 200 or 300 of these photographs, trying to figure out which point was which point in the photograph. You can just imagine how challenging that manual process could be when you were faced with this sort of a situation, and many others as well. Well, as a result of development in the computer vision world, essentially it is now possible to literally walk around something. You have to sort of follow some reasonable rules, making sure you're taking overlapping photographs, dump those overlapping photographs into a file folder, fire up the various software packages that can do this, and it will automatically process and create, in most instances, very decent three-dimensional representations. There's some tricks you don't want to use, for example, as a rule, variable focus lens. There's a bit more to it than what I'm letting on, but it compared at least to the old days, most individuals with some basic photographic knowledge and skills can create very quickly and very capably some very high resolution, very high quality ortho-rectified, that is to say, map accurate images. But more importantly, the process creates true 3D, what we refer to as point clouds. So in other words, not only is there an image produced, but there is a three-dimensional data set of the measurements that are reflected in that image. We're going to come back to that and look at that again, but this is a very, very important technology, a relatively low cost to implement. So I want to revisit this. This, I think, is a very important method for archaeologists to be aware of. There's more to it than I've said, but let me stop here because I think it is so important for archaeologists to be familiar with this strategy that I'd like to invite your questions at this point. Again, happy to take those either by the sound or if you have some chat room questions. I'll wait a little minute. It takes a bit for everything to catch up. Well, I haven't seen any questions. I'm sure that some may occur to you. Ah, I'm sorry. the questions were at the bottom of the chat room. It says, oh, will you provide a list of software packages that you work with? Would the 3D photography need to be rectified with total station data? And can you name the software? What's the best software? And so on. So I can answer all those questions. First of all, yes. We will give you a little bit later in this presentation when we sort of compare and contrast, we'll talk about at least three of the different software packages that we've worked with, which is EOS Modeler, I'm just pulling a blank here, 123D Catch, and the Russian software that name escapes me, but it'll come back to me in a minute. Photoscan, thank you. And that's by and large, most people are very pleased and very happy with PhotoScan. We'll talk a little bit more about pluses and minuses later on. They all have some strengths and some weaknesses, and we'll give you a little comparison chart for them. There are some other software packages out there, but we'll look at those in some detail. Another question that came up is, do I need to have total station data to ortho rectify or to rectify the data? The answer is not necessarily. And by that I mean, if you're interested in the data being correct and geometrically accurate, but you don't care where it is, so to speak, in the world, just everything in the imagery is okay, you don't need any other outside control. If you want to locate that imagery within this, as we said, geodetic space, then a survey strategy using a total station or something like that is necessary. Now, conversely, if the question is, do I need to put targets in the image and measure those targets with a total station, the answer is no. There are some limits. We'll talk a little bit about those limits, but essentially if there's a lot of what you might think of as irregularities or texture or detail, whatever word you want to use, in your photographs, then targets are not normally necessary. The software can compare these complicated images and figure out where it is. So to answer your question directly, some sort of survey is necessary if you wish to position the photographs in three-dimensional space accurately. It is not necessary simply to make the process of the photo model analysis work. It sometimes is helpful, however, to have these control points to validate or assess the quality of the result. To answer your question directly, though, you don't need, quote-unquote, a total station necessarily. Okay? Well, let's continue again. We'll come back to some of these questions. I apologize. I didn't realize that the chat window was, I'm going to make it a little bit bigger so that, so that I can follow the most latest questions. Okay, let's go on now to the next technology. And that is terrestrial, quote, laser scanning. And I put quotes around laser scanning because in many instances, the instruments that are used in laser scanning aren't in fact lasers. So here are some examples of different kinds of instruments. To the upper right and the lower right is a traditional, quote, laser scanner. In the middle is what is called a white light or fringe-based scanner. We see a variety of different instruments in the little video. If you're seeing the video, basically you can see an instrument operating, and these new instruments now automatically scan and rotate at the same time. So let's look at some of the details of these methods. But before we do so, let's talk about these 3D scans. What are 3D scans? It is important to understand that they are generally a set of X, Y, Z points in three-dimensional space. They may be referenced to an arbitrary point, for example, like a traditional archaeological site just has 0, 0. We're not sure where that is. Or it may have geodetic control. It may have a particular latitude and longitude or coordinate system associated with it. But it's a set of X, Y, Z points. In most instances, or in many instances, these X, Y, Z points, which are in three-dimensional space, also have an RGB. So that then allows us to have essentially a three-dimensional representation of an object or a site. But at the end of the day, when you zoom in, if you will, very intently, you'll see tiny little points. The density of those points is referred to as the resolution of the instrument. And we'll talk a little bit about resolution of instruments a little bit later. So when we think about this, there are a variety of different types of, quote, laser, close quote, scanners. The most common, probably, is something called a time of flight, or TOF. For example, the Leica scanners that many people use are time of flight scanners, as are ones from Trimble and a variety of other companies. They basically send out very quickly a laser beam, literally, it can vary from anywhere from a few thousand times a second to a half a million times a second, and we're beginning to see some instruments that are in the millions of a time a second. They basically fire the laser, measure the time that it went out, comes back. They measure the angles using a very precise mirroring system, and that allows the instrument to calculate a three-dimensional coordinate and perhaps an image as well. Sometimes images are taken later and placed over these point clouds. The next particular kind is called a phase comparison. Actually, phase comparison instruments work very much like modern total stations. They essentially send out a pulse again, laser beam, but instead of measuring the time of flight, they measure the phase difference. For the practical consequences, the time of flight has relatively high speed, relatively high accuracy, and has distances that probably go from in the neighborhood of a few meters out to, and it varies, 100, 200, to perhaps as much as 800 meters. Right now on the market, the 800 meter to kilometer distance is the maximum distance that most of these instruments are going to operate, with the great majority operating in the a few meters to 100 to 200 meters. The phase systems only are effective out to at least theoretically 79 meters as a general rule, but in fact they're effective from about a couple, 2 or 3 meters to about 50 meters. But they're typically much faster. And so, for example, if you're working inside a room, inside a building, inside a cave, basically where you have those sorts of controlled locations, phase systems can be quite effective. It's a complementary. These are not, one's not better and one's not worse. They're just different. Another type is called triangulation. These are often used for devices that basically do 3D point clouds for objects, and we'll look at some examples of that a little bit later. Essentially, this sweeps a laser line and measures it across a CCD that the lines come back. It uses standard trig and that sort of thing to figure out the dimensions. Then the final one that we'll talk about isn't really a laser scanner at all, but it kind of gets dumped into these, and it's what's called a white light or fringe projection system. And what this basically does is it takes advantage of the sort of traditional photogrammetry, but it simultaneously projects this very complicated grid system or pattern on what it's taking pictures of, and that pattern allows it to do very, very high resolution information down to the tens of micrometers, for example. So we can talk about resolution, we'll come back to it. Different techniques typically have embedded in them different abilities, different qualities of measurement, speed, size, and so on. But these are the primary ones that we normally think about. So let's just talk a little bit about how this works. And again, I know many of you may be quite familiar, but many of you aren't. This looks like a two-dimensional picture, and computer screens are inherently two dimensions. But essentially, what you are looking at is a three-dimensional representation of a part of the building. This is a building here on campus. Down in the lower right is where the laser instrument sat. And if you sort of think of it as a very high density flashlight being scanned quickly across the surface and measurements being done, that's sort of how it works. Notice the red arrow. There's a tree that's down close to the scanner. You'll see the shadow of the tree on the building. That is, in fact, a true shadow in the sense that there is no data there. So this is a very important part of laser data acquisition, particularly in complicated areas with other buildings or forests or what have you. Anytime there's something between you and the surface that you're trying to record, you will have a data shadow. You'll also see that this is one scan. Because it's essentially a beam of light, it can't go around corners. It can only do what it can see from one point. And so a building or a structure, an object, must have multiple scans. And so in this case, we would move the scanner so the tree wouldn't be in front of us for one part of the scan, but we'd also need to move the scanner in order to go all the way around the building, or in the case of an object, all the way around the object. And this is very important. That is essentially, and there are a couple techniques that sort of get around this, but generally speaking, all of the scanners in use require multiple scans to fully image even an object, definitely a building, and those scans must be merged or brought together. So every color you see here in this image is a different scan from a different tripod setup at a different point during the day. Those all had to be brought together. And I want to stop here and make a very important point for everyone to be aware of. Whenever you might think about getting a scanner, and again, whether it's an object scanner or a terrestrial building or structure type scanner, you read some specification. It says we have such and such resolution. That's perfect case. That's in a controlled environment. There's no dust, there's no difficulties and problems, and it's of a particular scan. It is almost certainly the case that as you merge multiple scans together, the overall precision, if you will, or accuracy of the data gets to be a bit compromised. So it's very important for you to understand that the published specifications may not be the practical specifications when you're out in the field. We're going to come back to look at that, but it's important to recognize that this scan merging process is one of the reasons that that's true. It's also important to know there are a lot of steps to effectively and correctly record and maintain the sorts of data that you get from these instruments. I encourage you to take a look at the source that's on the bottom, guides.archaeologydataservice.ac.uk. This is the Archaeological Data Service's Guides to Good Practice. You can Google that. There are very detailed guidances on how to record the various things. These aren't guides on how to do it, but it's, if you're doing it, this is some things you need to think about while you're recording the information. This is called metadata, and particularly for heritage purposes, where the object or the site may not be there in the future, this metadata recording is very important. We're going to look at some guidance on practice a little bit later, but this is some guidance on what you should record as you're recording data. So let's just think about this for a moment. We have what we might call a general 3D data pipeline. I'm presuming you're considering photogrammetry or laser, quote unquote, scanning because you want to get some three-dimensional data. You can sort of go at it from two different ways. You can scan a subject with a scanner, or you can take photographs of that. The scanner creates point clouds automatically, and you can apply textures to them. The photograph starts out with a texture, and from that texture in the software, you can derive these point clouds. You then have to clean them up. You have to remove extraneous data. You have to remove information that you don't want. You have to basically connect these together. That's the process of registering those. And then you're going to create, in many instances, a mesh. That most software deals with meshes these days rather than actual point clouds, so that's changing. And then you have data by which you can measure, analyze, represent, display, and so on. So I'm going to talk about another point now, and we'll come back to that. When you're thinking about all of these, the key question in looking at the technology parameters is not the technology, but what do you want to do with it? So for example, if your objective is, hey, I've got a bunch of interesting archaeological objects. I want to make those available to the public so they can see them. I want to put them in a website. I want them to be able to rotate them and move them around and look at them in all sorts of dimensions. Or I have an archaeological site. I have a large structure, a historic structure. I'd like people to be able to observe it and look at it. That's going to take one level of instrument and one level of technology to achieve the sort of, I'll say, visual representation. If your purpose instead, or perhaps in addition, is I want to create some information that I can then use to analyze, and I'm going to use this analysis, for example, of, let's say, a stone structure to measure stone dimensions, to calculate the amount of stones or the size of this or how large those were or what have you, I may have a set of different requirements. So the thing is, don't buy an instrument and then figure out what to do with it, but figure out the objectives and then determine what sort of instrument. And just to make a quick point, I'm going to come back to this again. If your purpose is, let's say you have a number of pottery vessels and you want to display those on a website and rotate them and do sort of interesting things with them, then probably the instrument that you could get to accomplish that is probably under $10,000 and perhaps under $5,000, let's say. If instead your purpose was to acquire data about that pottery vessel to support the analysis of manufacturing or to do various quantitative analysis or perhaps to do a variety of other comparisons and analyses, you might be looking at an instrument that costs $100,000. The point that I'm trying to make here is not that one is right and one is wrong, but make sure that you have a connection between your ultimate objectives and this, both the technology and the instrumentation. We'll show you some more examples a little bit later, but I want to seed that idea, have you thinking about it. We can come back to that as we move forward. Okay, While we saw that there was a sort of a flow in laser scanning, it's similarly true in photogrammetry. There's a lot of decisions that you have to make. You can quickly go around and do an okay job, but if your purposes are more substantive, you have to think about a lot of things. I'm not going to go over these at this point. We'll explain where you can go find out about these so that you can determine what's involved, but you do need to understand that if there's a scientific or recordation requirement, there's a lot of things that you need to think about. All right, so let's talk about some other questions that you need to think about that are sort of practical issues as you implement this technology. These may not be obvious at first. One of the things we've shown you in some of the examples that we've looked at so far are some high-resolution scans of Machu Picchu. Machu Picchu is a big place. It's in a complicated location. And in this particular case, we used a scanner, the company's name is Optek, that has a very long range, goes out to about 800 meters, and as a result, we were able to get a substantial amount of data from a relatively few positions. If we had a shorter range instrument, that might not have been possible. But even given that, you have to really think about what are the locations where you're going to place your instrument. Can I get coverage? Will I leave areas not observed? For example, if you have a building that has very complicated architectural elements, you may need a multiple set of scans in order to fill in a shadow, as it were, that's around the corner. Or if you've got a cornice that comes out, you'll have to deal with it. Those are very important questions about how to do that. And where will you put your instrument? Can you get your instrument there? For example, if you've been down to Machu Picchu, you know that Huayna Picchu is this very large, very high location at considerable distance from the site proper. Will your instrument allow you to gain that kind of information? So this whole process is very important. I mentioned, for example, a feature on a roof. The instruments, generally speaking, are located on tripods on the ground. You don't have the top of the building, for example. So you need to think about what are the kinds of techniques or methods or procedures that you can use in order to get your instrument up or to get your instrument in the appropriate location to acquire. So there's a lot of these sort of operational questions in the field that you need to think through. The lift devices that you see here, can be quite expensive to rent or to purchase, for example, but may be essential. Another thing that you need to think about is that these instruments, almost all of them use some form of light energy. Some of it's infrared, some of it's visible light, and it strikes the surface and bounces back. So there's an intensity. So one of the properties that you have to think about is what is the reflectiveness of the surface? Does it absorb energy? Does it reflect energy? These are important parameters that you have to think about, for example. A very important parameter that you have to think about is resolution. Many of the instruments that we've been talking about can literally gather data as low as at the millimeter level of resolution. But do we want to do an entire building at millimeters levels of resolution? The question basically depends upon what it is we're trying to accomplish. These three images here show the same area acquired at 2 centimeters resolution. By that we mean every dot is 2 centimeters more or less apart. 1 centimeter, every dot is more or less 1 centimeter apart. And then there's 5 millimeters, every dot's 5 millimeters apart. Well, you can see automatically that the time, for example, to acquire the data goes essentially up by a factor of 10. This is a relatively slow instrument. This is, I think, about an 8-year-old slide. But the point is that this is a very important question. More importantly, you go, let's always gather data at the highest possible resolution. That may be a good strategy, but you can be acquiring enormous amounts of data. So that's a very important question. I want to make a point here, however. If you go out and hire laser scanning done for you by a firm that does laser scanning, it's their objective to ensure that they do the lowest density of data acquisition consistent with your objectives. So that it's important for you and them to both understand what those objectives are. They're not going to give you a quote for laser scanning at 5 millimeters if they think, you don't need that because it adds enormously to cost. So you really need to think about the resolution, what am I trying to accomplish, What are the parameters I'm trying to measure? Those are all critically important initial decisions before you begin to do your data collection. Another thing that you need to think about with regard to resolution is that as these laser beams particularly strike edges, so for example, the edge of a corner of a building or what have you, very complicated things happen. And so resolution can very much affect the delineation of architectural features, for example, or in, for example, a ceramic object, the delineation of incising or various artistic elements. So unfortunately, this slide is probably too dark for many of you to see, but what this is showing is that the way in which you could delineate the edge of the window varies dramatically based on the resolution of the data. Or one comes out with a real irregular window edge, one comes out with a window edge that more or less accurately reflects the data. So this resolution issue is an important one. We can talk more about it. There's all sorts of interesting consequences of the decisions about resolution. Here's another example. You can see perhaps the CAD feature, for example, extracted from the 3D data. Another thing to talk about, but a lot of people don't realize, is when we say this instrument has X millimeters or X centimeters of resolution, that is at a particular distance. Even though these sources are optically controlled as much as they can, just like your flashlight, laser beams grow as they go farther out from the instrument. And the best way, and these are some tables, but perhaps is to look at this slide, and what you see here is those are some standard bricks, and that's the size of the laser beam in red, a beam that's, if the instrument was 20 meters away, and the beam, the yellow circles, is the size of the beam if it's 100 meters away. So as you can see, there's a lot of challenges that come, even though the beam perhaps is measuring every, you know, 1 centimeter, in fact, it's overlapping itself at that particular range. So distance, resolution, a lot of complex parameters go into the decision making about this process. Another factor that you need to think about is almost all of these instruments are strongly affected by vegetation. Most laser scanners, even the airborne ones, operate in an infrared portion of the spectrum. And so if you have vegetation, let's say you want to do a very high resolution map of an earthen mound, but that mound is covered in vegetation, you will probably, under most circumstances, do a very high resolution map of the vegetation. Okay, so I've got a few more sections here on assessing performance, but I've covered a lot of material. So let's stop for a moment and see if you have any questions over what I've covered so far. I've got one question that came in, excellent question. It says, how critical is the instability of lift as a variable that needs to be controlled? They are very important. And I thought about bringing that up, but I've got so many, probably frightening everyone about, you know, don't do this, it's too complicated. That's not the case. But it is a factor to take into consideration. Different booms under different configurations, the weather, wind can have a dramatic effect. For example, we had a project a couple of years ago, a large surface, and we had no choice but to get the instrument up in a boom. It was the only way to do it. There was a fair amount of wind, and you literally could see the waves, if you will, in the data set, even though the instrument was only moving a very small amount. So I bring that up. It's a very good question. The preferred solution is absolutely stable. So, for example, there is an instrument platform that the Ludwig Boltzmann Institute in Vienna uses that's this bolted together device that's a tower, and they can put different pieces on it and go up quite a distance, and it's enormously stable. So that's another way to go about it. But the stability of the instrument is very, very important. It says, what are the consequences of overlapping laser points when shooting from farther distances? That's a very good question. So if you remember that beam size, it showed a little dot in the middle, and then it showed the beam around it. The little dot in the middle is, as far as the instrument is concerned, the coordinates of the point. Okay? So the question basically is, what is the Z value? So imagine an irregular surface, and the point is at one point of the irregular surface, but the beam is striking the surface. So the depending upon the characteristics of the surface and the size of the beam, you'll actually introduce a z-value variable. It's different than noise, because noise has to do with the inherent properties of the instrument, but you can sort of see then a surface that might be, it will look noisier, let me just put it that way, as a result of that. So that's something to take into consideration, and you may, in fact, want to reduce the resolution as you go farther. There's a lot of complicated permutations in determining what's the best strategy at longer distances. High resolution at long distances is a very challenging set of strategies. Okay, whoops, hold on, I've got another question here, just a moment. Forgive me, I've got to scroll through these. Before the end of the presentation, would you please suggest any places to start with digital measurement if your organization doesn't have a lot of funds? I'll answer that question right away. Terrestrial photogrammetry, structure from motion, go out and get a relatively decent digital SLR with a fixed lens if you can, 50 millimeter, whatever, various permutations, and buy a copy of PhotoScan. If you're an educational institute, I believe it's $59. It's the cheapest, fastest way to begin going. It's not perfect. It doesn't do everything. But I'll come back to that point. By the way, we don't have any financial relationships with that particular company or anything, but I would say for the fastest, cheapest way to become familiar with this, that and obviously reading some of the literature. I'm going to be giving you some guidance on some sources of information and some things to read. Okay? Does that answer that question, I hope? Well, let me go ahead here, and if you have some more, keep bringing them along. One of the questions that comes up all the time is, so how do I judge whether this is working or not? Looks great. I've got the picture. I spun it on the web. Everybody thought that was great at the meeting. But am I really measuring what I think I'm measuring? And this is a real problem that we see with the application of a lot of these. People are so pleased that they have results that they're not necessarily asking themselves, how good are they and what are the factors that I need to think about? So let me just introduce a few of these things for you to think about. What's the accuracy of the system? What's the resolution of the system? How much noise is in the system? How fast is it? Can I repeat? So you say, well, if it's accurate, it must be repeatable. That's not exactly the same thing. Is it portable? For example, the fringe light scanner that you saw, you probably didn't, it wasn't clear, but it was actually being used in Chaco Canyon to do high resolution scans of rock art. That is an instrument designed to be used in the lab. We had to take generators. We had to take cables. We had to build basically plastic buildings in the field in order to protect the instrument. So portability is a big deal. The other thing that's very important with regard to portability is if you are traveling at all and you have a large device, you're going to have to check it in the aircraft. And you don't want to do that if you can help it. So one of the things that we always take into consideration is, are the instruments capable of being placed in carry-on luggage? So a lot of questions about portability, obviously range, or in the case of objects, how big an object can it do? Just little objects, big objects. What are the formats of the data? Can I actually use the data? What does it go into? What am I going to do with it? And obviously cost is always a factor of interest. So let's take a look at these. And again, I want to remind you, there are many instruments that can be very precise, but they're not accurate. And then they can also be not accurate and not precise. Lots of permutations of how these things work. I'm going to blast through the next slides because I want you to look at these in detail. I've given you the locations of the publications on the net. Everybody thinks that these devices are created equal. They are not. There are dramatic variations in the performance parameters of different instruments. Now, what you see here is some work that's done by a German group that they did. This is now some 7 years ago. But these are the results from different instruments. To make the long story short, if it looks crisp and sharp, it's good. If it doesn't look crisp and sharp, it's not. So you can see, just in these instruments here, enormous variation between those different instruments. Here's another chart that they produced showing that the noise that's produced by the different instruments at different ranges. Here's a table showing you some of the numbers. Again, I'm not going to go into precise detail. My point is to tell you that there is information, at least in some locations, about some of these things. Unfortunately, this group has ceased doing that head-to-head comparison. Here's an article from another source that looks at the accuracy of object or small object scanning devices. Again, I don't want to go into a lot of detail, but if you're just quickly looking at those numbers, you can see that there's a range of variation in them. Here's another article from the Forensic Science Journal. What they said, interestingly enough, is after comparing a number of instruments, they felt that 3D imaging was as high quality in its ability to produce measurements as traditional forensic techniques. So, and then they produced, again, some particular measurements with some particular instruments. The only point here, and I know this has gone by very quickly, the takeaway is not a particular number, but that as you make decisions, and if they are important, if there are scientific objectives or measurement objectives, don't just say, doesn't make any difference whether it's instrument A or B. It makes a difference. So what are those parameters? How important are they to you? What are the costs? What are the consequences? Are some decisions that you need to think about. Here's another thing to look about, and this is an almost an artificial comparison, but it makes a very good point. Many times, individuals will take an image, a scanned image, they'll look at it and go, oh, that looks good. But in fact, perhaps it's not as good as it might look, and let's explain. This, Rachel, our moderator, this is some of the work that she's done. There's two different data sets here, one that's much higher resolution than the other. And what we're looking at here is sort of this might be what it looks like at one level of our ability to observe it. And I won't go into the mathematics of the whole process, but you can sort of see, oh, okay, well, the one on the right looks, a quote, a little fuzzy, but the one on the left, you know, that's not so different. But what we're going to walk through as we look at increasingly finer levels of detail, and we'll now we'll go down to this 3 millimeter level of detail, we can see that the instrument on the right literally is incapable of reproducing the measurements that we see on the instrument on the left. If we don't need that level of detail, it doesn't make any difference. But if perhaps we're looking at the metrics, measurements of manufacturing techniques or something, this becomes important. Again, don't worry about the specifics. The detail that's important for you to be aware of is that there is enormous variation in the performance parameters of these different instruments. There's a reason in many instances, not always, I suppose, why the $100,000 scanner costs 10 times as much as the $10,000 scanner. On the other hand, maybe you don't need this level of detail for your objectives, in which case, why spend $100,000 or whatever the case may be. Okay, here's another thing to look at, and this is a very important point that you need to be aware of. The images on the left were processed with a technology called 123D Catch. It's an Autodesk product, has a number of advantages, but I'd like you, if you can, to compare the picture at the top with the picture at the bottom. What you're looking at essentially is some details on a lettering on the edge of an amphora, and the bottom one looks pretty good. We can see a lot of the details of the letters. The one at the top, however, is the three-dimensional data. What you're seeing in the lower image is the texture. That is to say, the photograph has captured a lot of detail, but the detail is not present in the actual three-dimensional data. So if you just want to see the letters, that's fine. But if, for example, the question was, what's the depth of incision? You know, I want to do some metrics. It literally isn't there. So that's why the visual representation versus the metric representation is very important. On the images on the right, it's both there in terms of both its texture and in terms of its three-dimensional data sets. Okay? Here's another important comparison of the two. If you have an object that is, let's say, for example, metallic is one problem area. If it's a surface in which there's not a lot of variation and variability, traditional photographic methods, terrestrial photogrammetry, won't do a very good job. That's the image on the left. The image on the right comes from, it could have come from a laser scanner, or in this case, it came from a fringe projection scanner. So the actual properties of the surface are a very important characteristic as to whether or not you'll get good or bad results from the processing strategies and the instrument that you use. Okay, a couple more and then we can pause again for some questions. I talked about the processing. Basically what we're looking at here is sort of that same information with a different photograph. So you can see that the 123D catch, which is processing photographic data, is giving different results than the photo scan, which is processing photographic results, than the photo modeler, which is processing photographic results. The one in the upper right, the Breuchmann, is sort of the reference data. It's the fringe projection scanner. The images on the left of the screen and the ones on the bottom are from the same data source processed in different software. So not only is the camera, in this case, important, but how you process the data is important. And so you asked earlier about some comparisons of pluses and minuses. I won't go through this table. There are many pluses and minuses. For example, 123D Catch has a really positive feature. It's free. So there are, again, things for you to think about as you look at the software, for example, that you might use in photogrammetry. And I think we've mentioned this before, but we will be making these slides available to everyone, so you don't have to madly write down some notes at this point. You'll have this information available. It's also available on our websites, which we'll talk about a little bit later on. There are other people that are thinking about this sort of thing. Here's an article from the Journal of Archaeological Science, for example. The final point that we want to make, and I've used up an hour so far, so we can certainly stop here if folks want to leave. I've got a few more slides to look at, so what are you going to do with all this data? But let me stop right now and ask if you have any questions, and if you do, then we can answer those now. And then for those that wish to stay, we can sort of look at, well, okay, so you've gathered all that data. What the heck are you going to do with it? So let me ask if you've got any questions. Making sure no one scrolled on the bottom. I don't see any questions. I'm throwing a lot of information at you. What I'm trying to do at this point is to give you some food for thought, some things to think about. We'll talk about how do I get more information about all of this. What I'm trying to do now is sort of raise some questions, sort of a consumer's report approach to it. Have you thought about this? Is that the proper automobile for your family? Do you need luggage? Those sorts of things. And we can come back and we can look at some of the sources of information that should give you more details if these questions become important. Again, I'm going to watch the chat. So if you've got a question, please go ahead and put it there. But for those of you who wish to leave, I appreciate very much your sitting in here for an hour. I know that's not always easy to do in one of these webinars. I've got a few more to sort of say, so what? And if you want to continue with me, be happy to do it, probably another 15 or 20 minutes.
Yeah, I think that's absolutely fine.
I think something like that. Rachel, are we okay if we do that?
Yeah.
Okay, so for those of you who have to leave, thanks so much. And if you want to hang around, we'll look at some examples of, okay, well, now that you've gathered the data, what are you going to do with it? So let's look at some implications. Oops, go back here, my apologies. One of the things that it's important to understand is that many people think of these three-dimensional documentation techniques as speeding up what we used to do. And I suppose there's an element of that, though it might be faster just to do what you did faster. because sometimes the complexities of these systems and other things may in fact increase the complexity of process. Not always, but sometimes. But there are many other things you can do once data are digital that you couldn't do before. So here's a few simple examples. The software that analyzes three-dimensional information allows all kinds of interesting metrics to be calculated. You can create all sorts of radiuses, and you can look at plane measurements, and you can look at angular deflections, and you can look at depths. A lot of things that can be easily done on 3D digital data that can't be done, or it's very difficult, even if you have the object in front of you. Here's another example. This is a an antique Greek vase. This is the sort of what we see on the surface. We can actually remove the texture, that is the photography. I don't know if it's very clear here, but we can actually see underlying the surface the various manufacturing characteristics. We can enhance those by using sort of shadowing. And so you can see, for example, many of the features of the lion were not simply there as a color, but were in fact incised into the ceramics. There's a variety of other features, sort of star-like features and things like that, that are incising. We apply here a curvature mapping so we can see the degree to which those edges were sharp and crisp and what those were. And so you can see that there's a lot of interesting characteristics. This is a very interesting project, again, from Greek antiquity. It turns out that as amphora were manufactured, basically in almost an industrial setting, they were stamped with wooden stamps, made by Bob. And so it turns out by very carefully measuring the size of the letterings, these stamps would wear as thousands of amphora were stamped with them, and you can figure out where in the production sequence the particular amphora might be based on the wear, the height, as it were, of the letters. Obviously, that measurement has to be quite precise. Here is another example where using a variety of analytical tools, you can extract features, you can look at various characteristics. In this case, it's the nature and characteristic of incising in rock art. The other thing that you can do is you can highlight the various three-dimensional characteristics. This particular project involved teasing out incised characters that were not clearly visible, in this case on a stela. It's also possible to see and measure many things. This is a artifact from Amarna, Egypt, and what the arrow is showing, you can actually see the fingerprint. So you can do fingerprint analysis. This is from the three-dimensional data. And obviously, to make a point here, which is relevant, the objects can't be removed in most instances from many foreign countries. Egypt is one of them. In other instances, because of repatriation or other questions, the objects may no longer be available. In that case, the three-dimensional representation may be all we have. And so it behooves us to think about what the future measurements are going to be on these objects. It's also possible to begin to perform automated style analysis. I won't go into it now, but there's a wide variety of new articles in the Journal of Archaeological Science on automatic style and comparisons and analysis, some very provocative stuff. This is an object. This is a ceramic vessel from the late pre-Columbian period in the Mississippi Valley. And what we're doing is sort of taking the texture on and texture off. So you can see that in many instances, the surface texture actually obscures manufacturing detail. So the ability to do this, the gray version is the actual three-dimensional data. One final example of that is the next slide, hopefully. And what you're seeing here is literally an on-screen capture of a, I'm not sure this is running here. So what you're looking at, hopefully, doesn't seem to be running. There we go. So what you're seeing here is the ability to use software to conduct very detailed, including the depths of incisions, all sorts of things, very detailed metric analysis of the 3D digital data. So particularly for those instances where the objects are no longer available, or we're having to make those available to scholars in other locations or what have you, this 3D representation process can be quite effective. I won't run the whole video for you, but there's all sorts of measurements that are being made using these digital tools. So the questions you come up with, no doubt, like, well, that was interesting, but how do I find out more about this, more about that? I'm going to call to your attention a couple of websites. And again, these will be available to you in the PowerPoint. gmv.cast.uark.edu is a national science-funded website that is essentially an attempt to gather together precise data on many of the technologies that we've been talking about. And it's not maybe very clear in this slide, but that first graphic says, if you want to do this, then these are some decisions you need to make. If you want to do that, then these are some decisions that you need to make. So this is a very good source to begin to investigate various possible strategies and various possible techniques. For example, if you burrow down into it, one of the questions it says, okay, what are you trying to do? So you remember me talking about the beam diameters and what have you. As you're walking through, what are the goals of your project? It asks you, you know, what are the distances you're going to have to deal with? Have you thought about beam divergence? What are the surface characteristics? Have you thought about reflectivity? So the website is designed to help you think through the sorts of questions that you might have and what are the best strategies. And it's designed to serve, you know, a broad audience in that regard. Here, for example, are some sections out of that site. And this compares, when should I use long-range 3D scanning? When should I use mid-range 3D scanning? When should I use short-range 3D scanning? What are its strengths? What are its weaknesses? What are the particular circumstances that I should think about? So this is, again, you can see the particular location on the website where this information is available. Here's an example doing the same thing, looking at photographic techniques. Should I use low altitude? Should I use terrestrial? Should I use RTI? We haven't talked about RTI. That's a related method that's, that has value in these sorts of situations. So this, again, is designed to help you think through the practical questions that you may face as you're trying to decide whether you want to apply one or more or all of these techniques, or perhaps bring on board someone that would be doing those for you. So I want to summarize things very briefly. This is unfair. It's a very complicated process, but essentially, which of these techniques do I want to use? So it talks about what's the cost, how far are you going to be, what's the capture depth, what lighting is required, what are the time parameters, what are your project goals. This compares then scanning to photogrammetry. And you can sort of see the pluses and minuses, the advantages and disadvantages. But the key point that I made earlier on, if the idea is to get started and you want to do it on a relatively low budget, starting out with photogrammetry, you can't lose. You will learn a great deal. The costs to get into it are relatively modest. The questions and problems are very similar to problems that you might encounter in scanning. There are some limitations. We've talked about those. There are some places where it won't work. There are some places where the measurements that you're going to get might not support your research. But nevertheless, all in all, it's probably a very good starting point when you're looking at these various techniques. Here's a list of some beginning readings that can give you more information about many of the techniques that we've talked about here. And these are sort of good places to gather more information, good places to start. And then, as you know, obviously, or hopefully you know, this whole presentation has been brought to you by the SPARC Project, which is another NSF-funded initiative in the Archaeometry Program. And the purpose of the SPARC Project is to make more widely available the kinds of techniques that we've talked about. And so Rachel is the director, the executive director of the SPARC Project. She is very knowledgeable about all of these and many other things as well. And she is an excellent resource. Go to the website. You can ask questions. You can go to the GMV. And one of the things that the SPARC Project does twice a year is it invites proposals from archaeologists and heritage practitioners. Those proposals are reviewed by a very distinguished academic and professional group. The high-ranked ones then, instruments that are available through SPARC are made available to the project. Staff resources in the SPARC team are made available to the project, or technical assistance is made available to the project, all at no cost to the project as part of the project itself, as part of the SPARC project. So, I probably, hopefully, raised more questions than I provided you with answers, but maybe given you an idea of some of the sorts of things to think about, some of the questions, those sorts of things. So, more questions, and I'm already beginning to see some questions come in, so let me, forgive me, I got to scroll up on the little, okay, first question was, have you seen instances where terrestrial laser scan data has been registered with low altitude aerial, forgive me, can't read it all at once here, low altitude aerial, I'm not finding it, forgive me. Low altitude photogrammetry of roof data. The answer to that is yes. A more common integration is with terrestrial laser scan data with LIDAR data. Again, there are some questions, some issues that you have to take into consideration. There are metric issues, was the photography rectified, ortho-rectified, those sorts of things. But assuming that the proper procedures were used, definitely it is possible to integrate terrestrial laser scan dating with aerial photogrammetry or in other instances in LIDAR data. And I missed that one earlier. I apologize. Okay, I've got another one. Does SPARC exclude CRM to propose projects that aren't commercial but that use data from commercial survey excavations? The SPARC project basically has been charged by the NSF Archaeometry Program to expand the use of these technologies throughout the archaeological community. It is specifically does not engage in competition with the private sector in the sense that if there is a data acquisition project, for example, that could easily be done by a commercial organization, that would not be appropriate for SPARC to, agree to participate in it. Beyond that, however, the key criteria that are always involved is, will the application of SPARC technologies and staff competencies to a project advance anthropological, archaeological science? That's the objective of the National Science Foundation's Archaeometry Program. So that's the key question. So the issue is not who did it or where it came from or anything like that. It's the nature of the question and whether or not the application can advance the science of the field. So in that regard, one of the things that is not done is SPARC projects don't, for example, record endangered archaeological resources. We all recognize that those are important. We're not saying that shouldn't be done, but that the resources that NSF has made available, they have made available with a particular focus. Another component, and there's a lot of details on the SPARC webpage, is that the organization that is submitting a proposal to SPARC, and I think it's every 6 months, Rachel can correct me if that's wrong, basically would have to be an organization that would normally be eligible for the receipt of National Science Foundation funds. And again, that's a pretty broad range, but it typically excludes non-U.S. institutions unless they have a U.S. partner. I don't know if that answers your question or not, and Rachel can give you more details on that as well. I think that was the last question.
To add quickly. I just wanted to add quickly in terms of whether or not commercial groups could apply to SPARC for support. As Fred said, the key criteria is something that is advancing anthropologically oriented archaeological research. And if you do have specific questions, clearly have a project in mind, get in touch with us, and we'll be happy to talk to you individually about whether or not your project is a good fit for our program.
Okay. Any other questions before we close? Again, I appreciate you bearing with me for those of you who have a little bit longer than we'd originally planned. Well, I think, Rachel, if you want to take over, and we're closing out here. We have a question about where the slides will be.